listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, the Fed says, okay, we're not going to buy $80 billion worth of junk. Actually, I think it was $40 billion worth of treasuries and $45 billion worth of junk. Toxic assets. We will take some of the bank's garbage every month. They're reducing that by $5 billion. So, you know, $5 billion, this is a big deal. It's tapering, but is it real? Is it meaningful? What does it mean? What does this have to do with anything? Let's ask Stephanie Kelton. She's an economist and associate professor of economics at the University of Missouri at Kansas City, research scholar at the Levy Economic Institute, the website neweconomicperspectives.org, one of the leaders in the new monetary theory program. And I know I'm getting that wrong, Stephanie. Welcome back to the program, first of all.
Really good to be back with you.
It's new money theory? New monetary?
Well, it's become known out there as modern monetary theory.
Modern.
Most people call it MMT.
Yeah, modern. That was the word I was missing. So much for stepping in and doing things on the fly here. First of all, I'm curious your take on the role of the Fed in general and this whole debate about whether the Fed should be nationalized and made part of the Treasury Department, whether there never should have been a Fed, whether the Fed as it is an okay thing. You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, you know, we have a Federal Reserve primarily to be there to act in times of crises. And so the Fed plays a really important role in the sense that it is the lender of last resort. And that's a function that we would not, you know, that's like you would be flying without a net to go without an entity in the economy that can be that lender of last resort in times of financial crises. And so, you know, definitely you need the Fed for that. What we've done, though, is to assign the Fed all kinds of responsibilities for, you know, taking good care of our economy. And so we give them a dual mandate and we say, look, guys, it's your job to make sure that we have relative price stability. It's your job to make sure that we have high rates of growth and low rates of unemployment. And so we ask the Fed to do these things, and presumably we do it because we think the Fed has the tools to achieve those goals, right? And what the Fed really has is a single policy tool. And in normal times, what the Fed does is just set the overnight interest rate.
Right.
That's it. That is monetary policy. And so if you think that, you know, being in control of this single price in the economy, the overnight interest rate, somehow gives you the power to carry out this huge agenda for, you know, maintaining a healthy economy in terms of inflation and output, I mean, for me, that's pretty fantastic. And so I think we've done a pretty bad thing in assigning those responsibilities to the Fed. And what we really should have done is made that the responsibility of Congress.
Well, and if the Fed is the lender of last resort, shouldn't the government be the employer of last resort?
Well, I think it should be. I mean, this is an excellent point. You know, we've watched the Fed now for 5.5 years try not just using its traditional policy tool, the short-term interest rate, but a whole range of, you know, unconventional policy tools, QE and Operation Twist and all this stuff with forward guidance and trying to manage expectations and finesse and massage and all these sorts of things. And after 5.5 years, you know, at some point you would hope that people would sort of wake up to the fact that it's not working, and it didn't work in Japan, and they've been trying it for closer to 2 decades there. So I think we do have to start thinking about alternative policies, and the employer of last resort is certainly one of them. I would couple that with a whole range of macroeconomic policies from fiscal side. But in conjunction with that, absolutely, it's time to start thinking much more broadly about what we need to do to, you know, start to rebuild this economy. Because, as I said, and you know full well, you know, after 5.5 years, we have barely clawed our way out of the ditch.
Yeah, I mean, this is essentially what Franklin Roosevelt did, and, you know, with the CCC, the WPA. He said, if capitalism is failing and they're not putting people to work, we will. And that ripples out through the economy.
Those programs were hugely successful, and we still have today, you know, many of the infrastructure investments that were made under the New Deal programs that you mentioned. And another one that was really important back then was the National Youth Administration, the NYA. That was a program specifically directed to hiring young people. And, of course, unemployment rates for young people are twice those of others. And so programs just like the ones you're talking about are definitely things we ought to be revisiting today.
We just have a couple minutes left, and there's something that I've been just dying to ask you about. What's your take on Bitcoins?
I'm sorry, on what?
Bitcoins. China has now banned
Bitcoin.
Them.
On Bitcoins. It
seems to me like the new Dutch tulip bulbs, but I, you know, what do I know?
No, well, I think you're exactly right. I mean, you know, I view them as some other form of speculative sort of a thing that investors can play around with for a while, and it looks like good fun, but at the end of the day, we're not talking about a currency in a meaningful sense, and certainly nothing that would ever rival the place of the U.S. dollar or anything like that. But, like, look, I mean, this is a little game that people invented, and they're having a good time with it right now. And I think it was down $500 just this week. So, you know, it may not be a very good investment if you're looking for something that will hold value, but a lot of people are going to get rich off of it, that's for sure, like with any sort of a Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, apparently a lot of people already have. Back to the Fed, the quantitative easing. You pointed out that actually in the founding document of the Fed, it mandates that the Fed have two principal priorities: to maintain low unemployment and to maintain low inflation. And during Greenspan's time, he said we don't need to worry about unemployment, just inflation, which was, you know, still seems to be echoing through. And you pointed out that basically the only tool they have is the overnight interest rate. What about this repurchase? And you know, and when Bernie Sanders and Ron Paul got that one-year audit, we discovered that the Fed was actually loaning trillions of dollars, not just to banks. They were loaning them to individual billionaires. They were loaning them to foreign corporations. I mean, it was like they were like propping up the planet.
Yeah, I mean, that's for sure. One of my colleagues, Randy Ray, at the university where I teach, he and a couple of his PhD students did a study that got quite a bit of play. They actually combed through all of the documents, and we're talking about tens of thousands of pages, looking at exactly what sorts of interventions the Fed made, you know, all these various things. And the number they came up with in their study was $29
trillion. Yeah.
So the estimate was that the Fed had intervened to the tune of $29 trillion.
Which is mind-boggling when the GDP of the entire United States is like $15, $16 trillion. But in the minute we have left, what, you know, is quantitative easing a good idea, bad idea? Should they do more of it? Should they stop it? Should they never have done it in the first place?
Well, I don't think they ever should have done it in the first place, and we talked a lot about this early on. You know, we said, well, Japan has already demonstrated the effects. I mean, we know what will happen, right? It doesn't do what people think it does. And so we were opposed to it from the very beginning just on the grounds that it was ineffective in terms of achieving what it purportedly tried to achieve.
But it does bail out the banks. I mean, it gets
the economy. Yeah, getting
it gets bad assets off the banks' balance sheets.
Right.
That seems like it's not necessarily a good thing, though. It seems like the banks should just go down with their bad assets that they put there.
Well, I think, you know, I think it's mostly a placebo. I think that to the extent that market participants think QE does something, it does impact portfolio decisions and so forth. But at the end of the day, you know, the Fed has started to taper. We got the announcement just under an hour ago. And I think we're going to, hopefully, everybody is going to be able to see by the middle of next year sometime that tapering was not really a
big
deal.
QE is the homeopathic medicine.
It really didn't do anything. So not doing it anymore won't do anything either.
Yeah, so QE is the homeopathic medicine of the... anyway, not to knock homeopathy. Dr. Stephanie Kelton, hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman
Program.
This guy
always steps on me. Dr. Stephanie Kelton, neweconomicperspectives.org. Dr. Kelton, thank you so much for being back with us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Great talking. And it's Andrew Campbell, senior producer with The Big Picture. Hey, Andrew, how you doing today?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. So tonight we're doing the Lone Liberal Rumble. It being Wednesday, I get to take on a couple of right-wingers.
Yeah, we'll have Kyle Peterson on and Horace Cooper. Horace is always fiery, and he's always a good entertainment value, so that should be fun. We're going to start off talking about how unemployment benefits are ending for 1.3 million Americans at the end of the month. This is one of the most notable things that was left out of the bipartisan budget deal. And we're going to really get into the notion that Republicans think that by cutting unemployment insurance, Americans are magically going to find jobs, and that's simply not the case. But from Rand Paul to Paul Ryan, they all argue it on the Hill, so we'll get into that.
On the other hand, if you want billionaires to do more, you have to give them huge tax cuts. You have to give them more billions.
Exactly.
But unemployed people, if you want them to do more, you take their money away from them.
Yeah.
This is bizarre.
I mean, last year, unemployment insurance helped keep 1.7 million Americans out of poverty.
Yeah.
It's really...
GOP senators vow to stop military pension cuts. These are the military pension cuts that the GOP senators put in the first place?
Yeah, the GOP senators tried yesterday to put in an amendment to the budget deal that would have stopped the proposed military pension cuts. Unfortunately, for them, that did not go through. It was not passed. But it really raises a question. Why are Republican senators interested in protecting the pensions of military retirees but not working class Americans that have worked their butts off throughout their entire lives and are really being screwed right now?
Yeah, because they like to pretend that they care about the flag. China rejects fifth U.S. corn cargo in a month, citing GMO strain.
Yeah, China is rejecting a lot of food imports from the U.S. lately. This is just the latest, but it really raises the question, if China's doing it, why can't the U.S. and why can't we have the right to know what's in our food and be able to make smart choices about what we're putting into our bodies?
Yeah, yeah. Michigan passes rape insurance laws. This is a law. This is pretty bizarre.
Yeah, basically it's a bill that's been put forth that punishes women for being women. That's essentially what it does. I mean, it's just this absurd. It's absurd, first of all, and it's just the latest continuation of the conservative war on women. So we'll get into that.
Yeah, that's bizarre. The minimum wage in Washington, D.C. is actually going up. Now, they had vetoed this thing of $11.50 an hour for Walmart, but it looks like within 2 years it's going to be that anyway.
Yeah, and they passed it unanimously, which means that even if Mayor Gray vetoes it, they'll be able to override it. So in 2016, it will be going into effect. It will start out at $11.50 per hour, and it will be tied to inflation.
Wow, and it's going to apply to everybody?
It's going to apply to everybody, and in the same hearing on Tuesday, the council also expanded paid sick leave.
Geez, that means I have to start paying you more than $11.50 an hour?
Yeah.
Oh, no. House Democrats, that's a joke, guys. House Democrats pushed to defund failed abstinence-only education programs?
Yeah, we're going to talk about this. Viewers might remember that earlier this week we had Gary Hobine on, who is a creationist, and he was talking about the rise of creationism in schools. Well, this is sort of the same thing. It's faith-based education, and it's really...
It's faith-based sex education.
Sex education, correct. And it's really teaching our kids the wrong thing, so we'll get into that.
Yeah. And then finally, we're going to do Everything You Know Is Wrong with Bill Becker about climate change.
Yep, he's the executive director of the Presidential Climate Action Project, so it should be a very interesting conversation.
I am looking forward to that. Andrew Campbell, thank you so much, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
Great seeing you. We'll be back. Welcome back, Tom Harbin here with you. Oh, this is fun. It's the end of the year. I just love playing these old clips. This is a flash from the past. When I was a kid, our government figured out a way to scare the hell out of us as kids. I mean, you know, George Bush with 9/11. He's like, you know, look out the. I had dinner with Ellen Ratner and a friend of hers who is a conservative talk show host night before last, who was telling me dead serious, not Ellen, but her friend, actually our friend, she's a friend of mine too, but she's a conservative talk show host, dead serious, really believed it, that there are Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps just on the other side of the border in Mexico, and they smuggle themselves across into the United States as Mexicans because they have dark skin. And so that's the duck and cover of this generation. Here's the duck and cover, if I have this right, of the that's going to be way too loud, of the 1950s. Listen to this.
Dum, dum, dee-doo, dum, dum. Diddle-dum-dum, diddle-dum-dum. There was a turtle by the name of Bert, and the turtle was very alert. When danger threatened him, he never got hurt. He knew just what to do.
Bert knew what to do.
Duck
and cover. This is in case the nuclear bomb goes off.
What we all must learn to do. You and you and you and you. Duck and cover.
Did you hear the boom first?
We must be ready every day, all the time, to do the right thing if the atomic bomb explodes. Duck and cover. This family knows what to do, just as your own family should. They know that even a thin cloth helps protect them. Even a newspaper can save you from a bad burn.
Yeah.
But the most important thing of all is to duck and cover yourself, especially where your clothes do not cover you.
Remember what to do, friends. Now tell me right out loud. What are you supposed to do when you see the flash?
Duck and cover.
Isn't that great?
Duck.
Now, I'm waiting for the, you know, I kept waiting when the Bush administration was doing their be afraid, be very afraid. You know, I kept waiting for there to come along some sort of, you know, campaign for kids about how to look out for terrorists. Just like there was this campaign for kids in the 50s when I was a kid that was about, you know, the Yertle the Turtle or Bert the Turtle. You know, he's teaching you. You could hear that bang. I don't know if you heard it, but early on in the ad, they would go, bang! And it didn't sound like a boom, you know, like an actual atomic bomb. It was just a bang, you know, like they hit a pan or something. And, you know, duck and cover. But it was pretty amazing. That, and then, you know, on a more serious note, also speaking of war, because I think that it's important that we speak of war and that we speak of peace sometimes. This is Dwight Eisenhower, and I played this speech, I know, in the last year at least once, but it's worth revisiting. This was on December 16, 1953. This was the second year of his second full year of his presidency, toward the end of it, around Christmas time, and a week before Christmas. And Dwight Eisenhower talking about what the real cost of war is. Now, consider, you know, there's this big debate right now. The Republicans are saying we can't afford $30 billion to extend unemployment benefits for people who, you know, so after the first of the year, for people who have been out of work for more than however many weeks it is that they pay for these days. We can't afford to extend this, and it's going to be about $30 billion. George Bush's war in Iraq cost $1 trillion. That's $1,000 billion, and so far, and it's probably going to cost more. And his war in Afghanistan cost $1 trillion. We got, you know, $2 trillion in the national debt now just because of these two wars. And that's just dollars. So Dwight Eisenhower tried to put it in a larger context. Here he is.
Every gun that is made,
every
warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense,
a theft
from those who hunger and are not fed. Those who are cold and are not clothed.
This is the real cost of war.
This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this.
One heavy bomber.
A modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is. Two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population.
This is one bomber, is what it costs.
Two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter plane with 500,000 bushels of wheat.
Single fighter plane.
We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people.
One destroyer.
This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron.
Now, as it was appropriately referred to as his cross of iron speech, but that was Dwight D. Eisenhower, a guy who had actually seen war, who knew the cost of war. So we are still involved. I don't know if you saw the news today.
But, you know, more Karzai, more Hamid Karzai news on the one hand. You know, they're cutting a temporary deal with the Taliban in parts of Afghanistan. They're getting ready to hand the country back over to the Taliban. And in Iraq now, yesterday, there was just this spate of bombings all across the country. The bloodshed in Iraq is like nothing you've ever seen before. And Americans don't care because we don't have soldiers there anymore. But we caused this. Remember Don Rumsfeld? Oh, yeah, democracy's freedom is messy. This was the freedom agenda. You heard yesterday Jim Jeffords say they're doing this for oil. And sure enough, Iraq is pumping oil like there's no tomorrow. And there's American oil companies involved. But Iraq, you know, had the good sense or whatever, I guess, to kick us out and align themselves with Iran. This really, I mean, the outcome that we wanted, George W. Bush's neocon policies, and we're still taking these people seriously?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I mean, John Bolton is still showing his face in public. Dick Cheney is still speaking out. George W. Bush, well, he's painting pictures of himself in the bathtub. What can you say? Talk media for the sane among us. And speaking of sane, we are now paying, and you got all these Republicans who are running around, you know, Paul Ryan and all the Republicans who just voted for this austerity budget, who are saying, you know, we can't afford things, we're broke, because George Bush declared two wars that cost us a couple $1 trillion, another trillion or so dollars in tax cuts for billionaires and wealthy people and big corporations. You got another $1 trillion in tax breaks for the oil industry and for the, you know, and the Jim in the news this morning is reporting how the super rich have skipped out on $100 billion in estate taxes just since 2000 by setting up these fancy trusts which get around estate taxes. And $100 billion, I mean, that's a lot of money, right? That's 10 years worth of preschool for every kid in America, for example. But I think the war part of it is the most egregious. The Pentagon budget is three times what it was in 1997. Let that sink in. Three times. And how did it get there? Well, in part, it got there through George W. Bush saying that, hey, we've been hit by al-Qaeda, so let's go attack Saddam Hussein in Iraq, who, by the way, hated al-Qaeda. Saddam kept al-Qaeda out of Iraq because al-Qaeda was, you know, and it represented a threat to his power. Saddam hunted down and killed al-Qaeda members, which is why we used to support him in part. But here's George Bush talking about that.
We know that Iraq and the al-Qaeda terrorist network share a common enemy, the United States of America. Right. We know that Iraq and al-Qaeda have had high-level contacts that go back a decade.
Yeah, it's a simple lie, right? And then you look back to the Franklin Delano Roosevelt administration.
We're not a warlike people. We've never sought glory as a nation of warriors. We're not interested in aggression. We are not interested, as the dictators are, in looting. We do not covet one square inch of the territory of any other nation.
But Dick Cheney was sitting in the White House organizing exactly how he was going to take the Iraqi oil fields in March of 2001, 6 months before 9/11. The exact opposite of what FDR said. And in fact, then he got Jerry Falwell to go out and, you know, on Fox News and basically, or CNN, excuse me, blow them all away in the name of the Lord. Really?
You got to kill the terrorists before the killing stops. And I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
In the name of the Lord. Where is that guy now? But what's most amazing is how our political rhetoric on the Democratic side used to be. This is a sitting president of the United States running for his second term in office. Franklin Delano Roosevelt in Madison Square Garden in 1936. This is on October 31st. It was just a few weeks before just a week before the elections. And he's running for president on a platform like this. Just listen to this. This is amazing.
We have not come thus far without a struggle.
Actually, before we get into this, let me explain what he's talking about here. When he talks about 9 years on the golden calf, Warren Harding was elected in 1921, and he dropped the top tax rate from 91% down to 25%, which set off a decade of just, you know, the roaring 20s, right? That was the fattened calf. Normal working people didn't get rich, but the rich got really rich from 1921 to 1929. He deregulated the banks. I mean, in fact, Harding's slogan was more less government, less business, and less government and business, more business and government. In other words, you know, privatize everything and deregulate everything. And he cut taxes. And then in 29, while Hoover, the third of three Republican presidents, Harding, Coolidge, Hoover, the third, you know, Hoover was president, just a year into his administration, the stock market crashed. And then for 3 years, he did basically nothing. And so you had 3 years of horror. So for 12 years, the Republicans had been running the country, and that's what FDR is talking about. So listen to that in that context.
We have not come thus far without a struggle, and I assure you that we cannot go further without a struggle.
And now we've had 32 years of Reaganomics, by the way. We should be talking like this right now
for
the last 32 years.
For 12 years, our nation was afflicted with hear nothing, see nothing, do nothing, government.
Hear nothing, see nothing, do nothing, government. In other words, deregulation, let the rich do what they want, don't intervene, keep taxes low, you know, and that, it's the exact same thing. I mean, the Bush administration is a repeat of the Harding administration.
The nation looked to that government, but that government looked away.
This is after the crash, of course, in 1929, because he came in 32.
9 mocking years with the golden calf, and 3 long years of the scourge.
The scourge.
9 crazy years at the ticker, and 3 long years in the breadline.
See, people got it. They knew what he was talking about. The Republican deregulation and tax cuts.
9 mad years of mirage, and 3 long years of despair. And my friends, powerful influences strive today to restore that kind of government with its doctrine that that government is best, which is most indifferent to mankind.
That government is best, which is most indifferent to mankind. Paul.
For nearly 4 years now, you have had an administration which, instead of twirling its thumb, has rolled up its sleeve.
This is FDR talking about the things that he has accomplished. And, you know.
And I can assure you that we will keep our sleeves rolled up.
And this is the point. I mean, here we had from 81 until 2008, basically. Well, here, FDR continues.
We had to struggle with the old enemies of peace, business and financial monopoly, speculation, reckless banking, class antagonism, sectionalism, war profiteering. They had begun to consider the government of the United States as a mere appendage to their own affairs. And we know now that government by organized money is just as dangerous as government by organized mob.
There you go. And see, he was talking about basically a government that had been taken over by the lobbyists and the war interests left over from World War I. And it's like, Obama should be talking like this. Listen.
Never before in all our history have these forces been so united against one candidate as they stand today? They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
This is Franklin Roosevelt. This is a genuine Democratic politician genuinely campaigning. And he's talking about how 12 years of Republican rule produced 9 years of boom and 3 years of disaster. Here we've had 30 years of Republican rule, which produced 20 years of boom and 10 years of disaster. And why aren't people calling it out the way Franklin Roosevelt did? Because he knew how to say it. I mean, he was basically, I mean, the people just went nuts on this, you know, when he said this. And then he says, and I'm going to say, I'm going to kick their ass in the next term. Reelect me. Listen to what he has to say in just a second when he comes back. I mean, the applause was just so long after he said, I welcome their hatred. And then he comes back.
I should like to have it said of my first administration that in it the forces of selfishness and of lust for power met their match. I should like to have it said, wait a minute, I should like to have it said of my second administration that in it these forces met their master.
And there you go. I mean, that is how Democratic politics, big D Democratic politics, should be run. This was a genuine progressive running on a genuine progressive ticket. This is Elizabeth Warren-style politics. I mean, quite literally, this is Elizabeth Warren-style politics. Calling out the banksters, calling out the fat cats, calling out the warmongers, calling out the people who, you know, who got all the bailouts, calling out the people who think of the government as their appendage. You know, why is it that the richest zip code in America is just north of Washington, D.C. now? Because it's where all the war profiteers live. Why is it that 70% of our federal budget, or 70% of the NSA budget is privatized, and we wonder why the NSA is out of control? Why is it that we have private prisons across America, and at between 3 and 5% of the world's population lives in America, but a quarter of the world's population of prisoners are in the United States of America? And the statistics, you know, and then you look at the racial and class and demographic breakdowns of those prisoners, and you don't find Jamie Dimon. You don't find the banksters among them. Unless somebody rips off the banksters. I mean, you know, Bernie Madoff is in there, but, you know, after all, he made the crime of taking money from rich white people. You don't do that. Right? Taking it from middle class white people, that's fine. Working class white people, and of course people of color, they've been taking their money forever. These banksters. It's time for a real change in this country. So what, in your mind, is the best way to bring about that change? I wrote a book about this, Crash of 2016.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And how I think this change is going to come no matter what. But get ready. Fasten your seatbelt. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Britt in Tucson, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on cable. Hey, Britt, what's up?
Hey, how are you doing? I applaud your actions.
Thank you. What's on your mind? What's on your mind today?
I want to talk about school loans and the demise of the new Americans that should be the next to lead the country, but are disempowered, miseducated. And then when they do strive to get that education, put into a sea of debt. I have a BA in international communications with a minor in Latin American studies, my effort was to understand the interculturalism of America, which was built on immigrants. But I am now in debt. I'm living in a house where I have to heat my house with my stovetop. I have no oven. I have holes in accessible, making the safety of my home non-existent. I have no hope of ever getting to repay those loans. Even if I was employed, it would consume. And as I've seen on another show on this channel, demonstrating how that is what will bring us down, not what will bring us up.
Yeah, I agree. This is the story that I laid out in the crash of 2016 was that when they decided to take down the middle class in the early 70s, that when Reagan came into office, the first thing they did was, you know, take down unionization, right? They started dismantling the unions, putting a guy in charge of the Department of Labor who was hostile to unions. We went from 25% unionization when Reagan came into office to around 7% now in the private sector. So number one. Number two, so people had less income. It was mostly working men at that time. Number two, mom goes to work, you know, or son or whatever, or dad gets a second job, whatever it may be. People started second wage earner households, two job households. That wasn't enough. By the end of the 80s, that wasn't enough. So people started running up debt on their houses. They started taking the equity out of their houses and converting it to living expenses. When they wiped out their houses, they turned to their credit cards. By the 90s, credit cards became widely available and you know, high, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 balances available to people. And so people put all this money on their credit cards. We've got $900 billion in credit card debt in the United States. Then people tapped out their credit cards, and it was like, okay, how else can we rip off the middle class? Oh, let's put their children into poverty, and let's make sure that their parents sign the notes so that when the children default, we can go after the parents for the last little bit that they've got left. And that's what's going on right now. We're in the cancer stage of this. This is the end stage of this absolute massive transfer of wealth from the American middle class, which got very, very wealthy in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And the 80s, 90s, and the 2000s have been spent moving that wealth out of the middle class and into the hands of the top 1%. And these are the ways that they did it. And your story is absolutely, you know, validates that premise. Am I making sense here?
Thank God for high school sports in my high school. I know that they are not all existent in other high schools, but it sounds to me, as an ex-ice hockey player, I can tell you it sounds like strategy that was built a long time ago, and we've been led down a path.
It was. I lay it out in the book how in 1971, Lewis Powell, 3 months before Richard Nixon put him on the Supreme Court, wrote a memo in which he outlined, here's how the rich people and the powerful people in the corporations can take over America. And then he proceeded to help execute it as a member of the Supreme Court. Britt, thank you for the call. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And there's so much of this stuff that I would love to share with you. Remember when Ronald Reagan said this? This was a good one. Whoops.
Next Tuesday is election day. Next Tuesday, all of you will go to the polls, will stand there in the polling place and make a decision. I think when you make that decision, it might be well if you would ask yourself, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Is it easier for you to go and buy things in the stores than it was 4 years ago? Is there more or less unemployment in the country than there was 4 years ago? Is America as respected throughout the world as it was? Is as safe, that we're as strong as we were 4 years ago? And if you answer all of those questions yes, why then I think your choice is very obvious as to who you will vote for. If you don't agree, if you don't think that this course that we've been on for the last 4 years is what you would like to see us follow for the next four, then I could suggest another choice that you have.
Yeah. Very, very kind of discreet and indirect. And at what point do you think Americans are going to wake up and say, you know, it's not just 4 years ago, it's like 30 years ago. This has been a slow, steady process. And it's been a slow, steady process by design. Ed, Saginaw, Michigan. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind?
Hey, good afternoon. I just wondered how one man can kill so many people by ordering those bombs, murder so many people, and Congress didn't do nothing.
Which one man are you talking about?
George Bush and Obama.
Oh, with Afghanistan and Iraq?
Right.
Well, for what it's worth, Obama's pretty much stopped the bombing campaigns in Afghanistan, and he's put us, I mean, there was that initial surge, but he's put us into a holding pattern. I think, you know, we just voted another $81 billion for war. We should have voted $81 billion for high-speed rail. We should have voted $81 billion to make the government the employer of last resort and start rebuilding this country. We should have taken just a couple million dollars of that and put it into the Department of Commerce to redo our trade laws. And get, you know, bail out of all of these trade agreements and go back to a protectionist trade policy. But yeah, not just how did George Bush lead to the deaths of hundreds of thousands, directly caused the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people and the displacement of at least 8 to 10 million people, 5 million people in Iraq and 3 to 5 million people in Afghanistan. how did he do that without being held to account? Other than, you know, most people saying that he's probably the worst president in our lifetimes and maybe in the history of the United States, right up there with John Adams, certainly is one of the worst presidents in the history of the United States. I think the answer to that question has to do with the media. I think it has to do with the defense establishment. I think it has to do with all the economic royalists, all those people that Franklin Roosevelt was calling out. Ed, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Jason in Albuquerque, listening on 1350 AM. Hey, Jason. Jason, you are on the air. Jason's listening to his radio, not his phone. There is a slight delay. You got to listen to your phone. David in Summerlin Key, Florida. Hey, David.
Hello. I was liking to tell you about the National Security Act of 1947. It's seemingly fueling the industrial military complex by not holding accountability to anybody at all. This okay. president can any time say, well, we got to spend this much money and not ask the Congress or anybody else that, heck, we got to do this for national security. And that isn't just oil.
Well, wait a minute. The president cannot spend more money that has not been appropriated by Congress. Simple fact.
Well,
he can move money from budget to budget, you know, but he can't do it if Congress tells him he can't. But Congress plays a role in this, too, and you and I play a role in electing Congress.
But a lot of times they can spend the money that's already been allocated and then have another budget to come back and fuel that has been taken away.
If you're talking about moving money from place to place,
been
yeah.
convicted for selling arms to Iran.
Oh, that was illegal. I mean, people went to jail for that. The Reagan administration saw more prosecutions and more convictions of senior administration officials than any administration in the history of the United States. It was the most corrupt administration in the history of the United States. David, thank you for the call. Carol in Camino Island, Washington. Hey, Carol.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I would like to update you on what's going on with the Boeing company and their dealings with their machinist union.
Oh, great.
Several weeks ago, they suddenly offered them a new contract, even though their old contract.
Right, and the union turned it down, and then you had Missouri offer Boeing $1.7 billion if they'd move there, and et cetera.
Yeah, there's a bunch of states that are offering them a lot of money to move
right.
there. And they told the machinists if they didn't accept this contract, they would be moving.
Right.
So the machinists, they gave the machinists 1 week to decide on this. And, of course, the machinists were very angry because it was a lousy contract. It took away their pension. And so they voted it down. And so Boeing said they were moving. Well, then the machinists started thinking about it, and their union approached Boeing, and they negotiated for 2 more days. This was sometime last week.
Mm-hmm.
And Boeing made another offer, which was slightly better, and it might have been voted in just so that they would not, you know, the machinists, of course, don't want them to leave.
Right, they don't want to lose their jobs.
But the union leaders just dismissed it out of hand. They didn't even put it up for a vote.
Hmm.
And the machinists now are pretty angry about this because they would have liked to have had a say. So I'm very confused. I understand Boeing would like to break the union, but I don't understand why the union leaders are basically turning their rank and file against them.
Which union is this?
The machinist union.
This is the machinist union. Let me see if we can if Sean can get somebody from the machinist unit to come on and talk about it. And if there are any members of the machinist union, I mean, we're on several radio stations in the Seattle area and a bunch of them in Washington State. If there are any members of the machinist union or anybody who's in the union management who would like to address this issue, give us a shout. Go to TomHartman.com. Our phone number is right there. Carol, thank you so much for the call. I'm going to try and find out what's going on. Thank you.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. EdisonFactor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
So we all know that Rudolph the Reindeer is a pretty terrible song, right? Michael Schaefer writing about this over in the New Republic. Santa's too cheap to buy headlights. And so he's got to get this, like, you know, what, alcoholic reindeer or something. He's got a bright red nose. But the other reindeer are all bullies, and Santa puts up with it. And, you know, there's all this kind of weird stuff. But that's nowhere near as weird as Megyn Kelly going off on this. Well, you know, Santa Claus is white. I'm assuming the corollary to that is Santa Claus speaks English. I lived in Germany for a year. Santa Claus spoke German over there. Ellen Ratner, I was at her home last night. Grover Norquist dropped by. It was very interesting. Anyway, Ellen's house last night, and she's just back from South Sudan, where I've been there with her, and to Darfur. And there's a large, you know, Christianity's made a big dent in South Sudan, and Christmas is a big celebration there. And Santa speaks Dinka over there. So, and looks like a black guy. So, you know, what's the deal here? What's going on? I find this all very, very interesting. Kevin Jackson is with us. Excuse me, Kevin. conservative commentator and host of the Black Sphere and contributor to the Daily Caller. TheBlackSphere.net is the website. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. Good to talk to you again.
Thanks for joining us, sir. Thanks for being back with us. You're African-American. What are your thoughts on growing up black in an America where all the positive symbols, whether it's beauty, you know, is white, you know, all of the ladies on the covers of the magazines, whatnot, and Santa is white. I mean, isn't that what do you feel about? How did you feel about that?
Well, I'm glad you're concerned, Tom. First of all, I don't believe that all the, quote, positive images were white. I will admit that, you know, growing up, a lot of times with the publications that were out there, Ladies Home Journal or Vogue or whatever, they tended to have white women, you know, dominating, you know,
Porn was mostly white women, wasn't it?
Yeah, that you'd have to ask somebody else.
Playboy, but Penthouse. I mean, I remember that stuff when I was a kid, you know.
I remember a lady in Playboy. She ended up in a Michael Jackson video, and I know she was a Playboy centerfold back when I was in high school. Uh-huh. But anyway, I never thought of Santa Claus as white or black. You know, he was a figment, and he was as a poor black kid growing up in America, I was always happy that he was there.
Right.
So I never thought about it in terms of color. And what's interesting
about—
Did
your dad play Santa? Did he dress up?
Yeah,
were there black Santa role models in your neighborhood and community?
You know, nobody thought about Santa as black or white, but I will say this. When my mom married my stepfather, and I talked about this in my article, my stepfather played Santa 1 year, but they were together 1 year before my mother died.
Yeah.
So he played Santa. But what was interesting about it was we knew he wasn't. You know, it was obviously him.
Right, but it was you didn't know he wasn't because he wasn't white. You knew he wasn't because you knew Santa wasn't a real guy.
No, I was young at that time. I believed in Santa.
Uh-huh.
And you knew this was
your stepfather.
But I knew that the guy playing Santa that evening when my mother woke me and my brother up was not Santa. It was obvious to me and my brother that it was my stepfather because Santa was black. He was really skinny, and we knew he had a pillow in his Santa outfit.
Yeah.
But they wanted to do something to sort of reinforce this concept. So, but the point of it is this, and this is where I have a problem, Tom, with all the protection that we have to have from Santa Claus as black people, is this lady, Aisha Harris, who wrote this article, who wrote the article, the one that Megyn Kelly was talking about, made the comment that she felt less as a black person, like there was some problem with her because Santa was white. And I'm thinking, what parent would let their child suffer from that? That's not a Santa problem. That's a Aisha and her parents problem. If Santa were black, or, you know, let's use something that you white folks can think about. You know that George Washington Carver was black, but I don't think you have a problem with peanut butter. So what is the big deal?
Well, I don't think most Americans realize that George Washington Carver invented peanut butter. And if they do, it's sort of that, oh, here's the one thing that one black guy did during the scientific history of the United States.
So that's the
problem, it's almost tokenism.
The problem there is ignorance, because black people have contributed greatly to the fabric of America.
I know that. But as a society, as a culture, I mean, Dick Gregory does a wonderful riff on this in his album, The Light Side, The Dark Side, that came out back in the late 60s, early 70s, about how we say, you know, somebody went to the light side, they went to the dark side, right? To say good or bad. So, you know, he's got a black heart. That means he's a bad guy.
What about your financial statement? If you're in the red, you're in bad shape. Do Indians get mad? If you're in the black, you're in good shape.
I don't think that's the exception that proves the rule. I think, you know,
what about a black hole? It's the most powerful thing in nature. It's the most powerful thing in the universe is the fact that it's a black hole. Look, we can parse these things. This is where I always get, I have a problem with the left. They always want to look at things from a black perspective and try to get me to feel guilty. You know, I feel less like, you know, Kevin, you didn't grow up with a black Santa, so why didn't you feel worse? Why don't you feel worse about America? I don't have to. I'm confident in myself.
Well, I wasn't asking the question how you felt about America.
Well, just the idea of, you know, you've had all these images that show white people
isn't it, well, you know, ultimately, Kevin, let's not personalize this. Isn't it okay to say to little black kids that there might be a black Santa?
I think it's disingenuous to tell to, first of all, Santa's a figment. Let's just
right.
admit
so
that.
If he's a fictional character, can't he be any race?
But if he's a fictional character, then why don't you make Hansel and Gretel black? Why don't you make Daffy Duck black? Why don't you make every
Daffy Duck is black.
Okay, well, good point. The point is, why don't you racialize everything? We don't need protection from a figure of good. And it's okay, Tom, if you white people have a symbol that we black people go, you know what? That white guy's not that bad. It's okay. We're going to survive it.
Right.
We've got enough imagery in the black community with real people, the Oprah Winfreys, the Barack Obamas.
I don't disagree with all of that, Kevin. I think that's a very, very rational perspective. But then a white beauty queen comes on and says, oh, by the way, kids, and she's speaking to all the children of America, including the black kids of America, Santa's white, and so is Jesus. Just get over it.
Well,
isn't that over the top?
Well, no. Well, first of all, the fact that she says Santa is white, she's right. That there's nothing wrong with her being right. Santa Claus was created by the Dutch, and then it went to Germany and other places. So she's not wrong about that, and it's okay.
But it's based on a saint who was a Turk, you know, who, you know, today would be profiled by the NSA.
Well,
because of the color of his skin. He wasn't African-American, but, you know, he was kind of almost North African-American.
You can say it was based on that, but the point is that at some point he became an iconoclast in the idea of American by
a
guy.
It's a Northern European tradition.
Northern European tradition. So the point is that it has nothing in Africa in it, nothing about black people in it, so it's okay. You know, we will survive this. If blacks need our own icons, we can create them, and we can perpetuate them any way that we choose. Now, the idea that blacks feel that we need to colorize Santa to make him black to make our kids feel better, I think is a sign of weakness. What it says,
I think it was a sign of weakness when Hasbro came out with, you know, black Barbie and started having black dolls for little black girls to play with. What's wrong with that?
I don't believe that it's a sign of weakness. Hasbro can come out with a Barbie that is a black doll. It doesn't have to be.
I think
that's
just meeting a marketplace. I mean, if somebody's going to be doing Santa coloring books for kids in the black community, why not have
No argument with that.
Okay.
I agree.
All right. Kevin Jackson, conservative commentator, host of The Black Sphere, contributor to The Daily Caller, the website The Black Sphere, SPHERE.net. Kevin, thanks for a very reasonable conversation. I appreciate you dropping by.
My problem.
Good talking with you.
My pleasure.
Thank you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Come on. Michael Schaefer is going to be with us from the New Republic about Rudolph. And I want to share something from Martin Luther King about this. Welcome back. And Ron in La Plata, Maryland, watching us on Free Speech TV. Ron, thank you for sitting on hold for 25 minutes, 49 seconds. What's up?
That's perfectly all right, Tom. I'll try to make this short, but I'd like to say something.
No, it's fine. That's fine. Go for it.
What the previous gentleman had to say. The president cannot use money without approval of Congress. Is that what you said?
I said the president can't spend money that Congress hasn't appropriated. Now, he can spend it in ways that Congress might not have intended, but it has to be within a budget that Congress has established. And if Congress does sloppy legislation that allows the president to basically have a slush fund, that's bad on Congress. The Constitution is very clear. The president has no appropriation power whatsoever. There's no monetary powers defined in Article 2 of the Constitution. It's all Article 1. It's all Congress. In fact, it's all the House of Representatives.
I understand that, Tom, but what about discretionary spending?
Discretionary spending means spending that's not mandatory. In other words, Social Security, people have an absolute claim to that money. That's mandatory spending. Medicare people have an absolute demand. You know, that money has been established for people as you can spend this. The defense budget, the military budget, it's not considered discretionary. It's considered mandatory spending. This is something that is absolutely necessary for the expenditure of the United States. The EPA, on the other hand, some of the food stamp programs and things like that, those fall into the category of discretionary spending in as much as they can be spent at the discretion of both Congress and the White House. You know, Congress does not have to pass new laws to change the way that money is spent.
Okay, I'd like to say something about this because back in last spring or early summer, the mayor of Washington, who did not want to use his money from out of his coffers, to give to somebody. So he went to the president, and the president agreed to give the National Cathedral $15 million for repairs of damage that was caused by the earthquake.
That was the fracking earthquake we had here in D.C., right?
Yeah, well, they said it was centers in Virginia. But regardless, he gave them that money. Now, that's unconstitutional to start with.
Well, it's not if he took it out of a budget that was like a FEMA budget or something, because it looks like that earthquake was caused by fracking. It's a natural disaster. And the president does have a budget for natural disasters. It's in the FEMA budget. I'm assuming that would be where that money came from.
Okay, but not to give to the church.
Why not? If the church is a national treasure, if it's defined as a national historic monument and it's been damaged.
Any way they want. It's used for religious purposes.
The National Cathedral is not just used for religious purposes. It's also the place where presidents are buried. It's also the place, I get where you're going, and I could probably make the argument for you, but I also think that I think that there's some benefit in having a place that is not a government building that is full of pomp and ceremony that is marginally associated with religion, even though the government doesn't by and large use it for religious purposes, unless you're calling a funeral a religious purpose, which I suppose you could. But anyhow, Ron, I get your point. This is one of those things where I could probably argue either side of it. Ron, thanks for the call. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. In 1 minute and 25 seconds, Michael Schaefer is going to drop in, and we're going to talk about Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. But first, following up on Kevin being here, our guest, who was saying it's fine with him as a person of color that Santa is white. He's not going to get all bent out of shape out of that. Now, Martin Luther King was not talking about white Santa, but I think that there's some value in this clip that I want to play. I want to share with you Martin Luther King.
Modern psychology has a word that is probably used more than any other word in psychology.
Modern psychology.
It is the word maladjusted. It is the ring and quiet of modern child psychology, maladjusted. Now, of course, we all want to live the well-adjusted life in order to avoid neurotic and schizophrenic personalities. But as I move toward my conclusion, I would like to say to you today, in a very honest manner, that there are some things in our society and some things in our world for which I'm proud to be maladjusted. And I call upon all men of goodwill to be maladjusted to these things until the good society is realized. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust myself to racial segregation and discrimination. I never intend to adjust myself to religious bigotry. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few, leave millions of God's children smothering in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society.
There you go. So that's you know, just kind of the serious note on it. Now, on a lighter note, Michael Schaefer's on the line. He's the editorial director over at the New Republic. NewRepublic.com is the website. If you don't read the New Republic, you should check it out. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, bad guy? Santa, bad guy?
He's not a bad guy, but that song, you know, I've young kids, so I hear them singing it.
Uh-huh.
And that song is a terrible, terrible song. Think about what it says. Like, there's this guy, right, this little reindeer. He looks funny. There's nothing actually wrong with him. It's not like he can't fly or anything, but he is because he's got a red nose, they tease him and they exclude him. They won't let him play in the reindeer games. And then after he proves that he is useful, they're like, it's cool. We love you. You're going to go down in history. And I actually think that's pretty horrible. And it kind of, as a song, it sort of winds up spoiling the whole story. So,
because it's a story about bullying a guy who's different.
Well, yeah, and you're like, if Santa's so great, why is he putting up with this?
Yeah, but on the other hand, Rudolph kind of transcends the bullying. I mean, you've got people like Bill Gates who appears to have Asperger's. I think, you know, Norm Legend in his book Diagnosing Jefferson makes a very, very strong case that Thomas Jefferson had Asperger's. You know, people on the autistic spectrum who no doubt suffered a lot of bullying and exclusion through their childhood years, who ended up rising above it. Isn't, in a way, the Rudolph story the story of rising above the mediocre masses who would make fun of you and discovering your own inner brilliance?
Oh, totally. And there's nothing wrong with that, except that in this particular song, the people who are doing the bullying, it's not like they ever apologize. We're supposed to think Santa's a great guy. And I don't, you know, it's sort of like saying, hey, kids, like, you should get bullied because it'll make you stronger.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's, I mean, you know, I'm obviously being facetious about the song.
No, I understand that, but I think it's, you know, sometimes our stories.
I don't actually think it's cool. If it was about Rudolph being bullied by some strangers who, you know, who go down in infamy, and then he triumphs, like, that's kind of every happy story ever.
Well, you know, stories are the way that cultures transmit values. And so stories actually are important. You know, the story of the little boy who cried wolf. This is a value that we transmit in our society. The story of the little boy who said that the emperor had no clothes. These are ways, and in you know, pre-literate societies, that's pretty much in the entire way
mm-hmm.
that values get transmitted. In our literate societies, we still transmit values by stories. And in a way, one of the subtexts of this story is that Rudolph's maladaptation or his difference, his uniqueness, was not of value until it was of functional value, economic
right.
value, let's say. You know, he could
right.
pull the sleigh or he could guide the sleigh because Santa was such a cheapskate he didn't want to buy a headlight.
Right.
Am I making sense here?
Yeah, exactly. And that, you know, I mean, people, they ought to accept people for who they are, and it turns out they accept him for who he is only after who he is turns out to be useful to them, when they should have got a headlight in the first place. And those other reindeer, I mean, it's not like fog is unheard of on Christmas. You know, what's wrong with them? They're doing all this practicing in the reindeer games, and they can't practice orienteering their way in the dark? Come on, guys.
Yeah, there you go.
Get with it.
And you also write that St. Nick's continued status as CEO of the world's largest gift delivery operation highlights a more modern capitalist flaw, the self-perpetuation of irresponsible elites.
Right. So he's got like billions of dollars of toys to deliver. Right. This is an enormous logistical feat, and to not plan for poor weather seems like a very irresponsible thing to do. It's like Rumsfeld, you know. He kept getting to keep his job despite all evidence that there was this sort of irresponsible planning that had gone on.
Oh, but freedom's messy, you know.
Well, yeah, it's Christmas, right?
Right. So Santa failed to plan for fog, and right. and thus he needed Rudolph.
And I think anyone who consults a meteorologist would know that the fog actually is sort of it's been known to happen on Christmas.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you're doing this tongue in cheek, and yet I think that there's an interesting message here. What, other than sensitizing people to it, would you suggest we do?
Do about what?
About the fact that, you know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is the story of bullying and capitalism run amok.
I don't think anything. I mean, I think other than sort of being aware that our songs have sort of funny meanings.
There you go. I think the Cinderella story is, you know, it's a story that perpetuates the oppression of women. I mean, you know, consider that story. You know, her only value was her looks, and the gift was a guy, right? The prince and all that kind of stuff. So I think our stories are important, and we do need to call them up. Michael Schaefer, hang on just a second.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That guy steps on me every day. Michael Schaefer, editorial director at the New Republic, newrepublic.com. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Rudolph. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. On the first day of Christmas, Tom Hartman said to me, Sue Nethercutt writes, occupy something, tag, you're it. Bring my job home, he said to Mitt. Cut tax cuts, don't eat my town, health care for all, inform the people, end Congress bribery. That's the seventh day of Christmas, eighth day, clean up our fuels, 9, cut defense spending, 10, bring back the unions, 11, people are people, and 12, cooperation. These seem suspiciously, Sue, like the chapters in Rebooting the American Dream. But pretty good. Pretty good. Anyway, hey to Sue and all the folks in our chat room. Interesting. Very interesting. Raymond in Roy, Washington. Hey, Raymond. Thanks for listening to, it says AM 1090, but I think it's something. It must be something else you're listening.
Yeah, and AM 1030 out of Shelton sometimes. Too.
Ah, okay. So what's up, Raymond?
Hey, I'm great, but I'll get better.
Okay.
You know, you had the the black commentator on. I wonder about his age, because at the tender age of 61, which I am, I remember growing up in Beaumont, Texas, seeing nothing but white faces on the television, white faces in the newspaper, white. Everywhere. And so I begin to wonder sometimes as a child, was my family the only black family around? And it took me years to get over that thought that, gee, there were more black people out in the world that were doing good things, because we weren't taught back then that there were any black people doing anything good. All we saw was the Amos and Andy shows and stuff like that. Right. So this guy, it makes me wonder, does he know the black history and the struggle that myself and others have gone through?
Well, I just saw his picture. I mean, he was on video. He looked like he was in his 30s, but I just don't know. And I think that rather than talking about Kevin, since he's not here to defend himself, we should probably talk in the abstract. I think that there is Joe Madison and I had this conversation over dinner half a year ago or so, about our kids. You know, he's got kids about the same age as my kids, and how our kids are growing up in a multiracial society. His African-American kids have white friends. My white kids have African-American friends. Wasn't so common in our generation. Our generations were more segregated. Now, they were segregated by law up until we were, hitting our early teens. But that it seems that that in that regard, anyway, America is becoming a much healthier nation. But it's also a generational thing, you know. And we were talking with somebody about the white racists the other day on this program, and I forget who it was, but she said, you know, we basically just have to wait for them to die off, you know, the old white racists, and because they're not being replaced by young right. Well, there are some, you know. You go over to one of the right, you know, white power websites like Stormfront.org, and you know they're out there, but you know they're really, really a minority now. They're not.
Well, yeah, but in the abstract, too, because my son is now 18, 19, and my daughters are in their 30s, they do live in a multiracial society, but the downside is that a lot of that, of the black generational kids in that generation, they haven't been taught the history. They don't know what the struggle is, and they go, oh, well, I don't see any problem with, for instance, a white Santa. Well, I did when I was a child, and I did see a problem with a black Jesus.
Right.
I was like, where's my Savior? Where's my Santa?
Yeah, and this was, and I shouldn't characterize Joe when he's not here to speak for himself either, but this was essentially, you know, his concern. My concern was that my kids didn't see government the way I did because I lived through the Vietnam era where government was trying to kill me. As a white guy, government was trying to kill me. And his concern was, he shared that, but also that his kids hadn't seen government systematically oppressing black people. And so his kids didn't see government as you know, not just government, society as that, as much as he did. And how do you transmit that story to your children? How do you, you know, without just sounding like a cranky old man who's yelling, get off my lawn?
Well, that is done through education.
I think you're right.
We need to have history taught, and we need to bring back the old civics classes of the old.
Yeah, I'm with you, Raymond. I'm with you. I think I absolutely agree. Raymond, thank you for the call, and appreciate it. Thank you very much. Charles in Glenwood, Illinois. Hey, Charles, what's on your mind?
Hey, how you doing today, Tom?
Good. You wanted to talk about black and white Santas?
Yeah, actually, I want to go to a deeper mode of it. When you take a child and you raise it up a certain way, that's the way that the child is going
to
go.
Paraphrase Proverbs, yes.
Right. In this country, I mean, we have to be honest and truthful when we're talking about things. White people have been fashioning themselves into gods. And they want us to react to them as gods. I mean, even if you look at the imagery of Jesus, who anybody that knows real religion knows that Jesus Christ was not white. He wasn't classically Caucasian. And then you look at a Santa image and then you say, okay, well, what's the purpose of that? If I tell you that every time you do something bad, the only reason that I don't kill you is because this imaginary white man stops me from killing you, then you start worshiping that imaginary white man too. Mm-hmm. And then you have elevated him to the point where we associate you with his greatness.
Right.
You understand what I'm saying? So it's deeper than just the Santa Claus theory. But Santa Claus is a continuation of that because Santa Claus is being posited as a representative of God on earth because he comes from St. Nicholas, who was a Turkish saint.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so you have to tell the truth about the truth when you're telling the truth.
Yeah, there you go. I think there's a piece that has to do with money, too, here, Charles, because the reason why in the 20s and 30s and 40s, as the advertising industry was really created in the 1920s, Edward Bernays invented modern public relations and modern advertising. And then in the 1950s, it became a major industry out of Madison Avenue in New York City. And the reason why that industry chose to market a white Santa to white people was because at that point in the history of the United States, right up through the 60s, arguably, virtually all the money in this country was held by white people. And so if you were looking to sell product and make a profit, you wanted to market to white people. And black people were kept out of the mainstream. I mean, black people could not even go into a good restaurant or a good hotel. By good, I mean, you know, expensive in a way, part of the industry that would buy advertising. Okay, I realize there were, you know, some really great black institutions back in the day during segregation, but they weren't going to Madison Avenue for advertising. They weren't advertising in the mainstream press. Their advertising was limited largely within the African American community, and so you could argue, I think, that. But the combination of the civil rights laws in the 1960s and Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty in the 1960s, which did a lot to jumpstart a black middle class in this country and, you know, cut poverty in half in the United States in 10 years, has made African Americans a significant economic powerhouse in this country. And now there's a reason for and then, you know, you break through shows from, you know, the Cosby Show in my generation, my early generation, to the modern breakthrough shows like Scandal, you know, of characterizing blacks as part of the mainstream of America and thus not just the social mainstream, but the economic mainstream, is going to cause those who own the economy and control the economy and make the decisions, like advertising decisions about the economy, to start showing black faces in positive ways, to start showing black women as beauty symbols, to start showing black men, African-American men, as not the stereotypes that they have been as necessarily like physically strong or something like that, but as powerful people, as, you know, in Scandal, you know, the leader of the agency that's even more powerful than the CIA, that kind of thing. That's coming about as a consequence of economic power, that it's all follow the money. Am I making sense here, Charles?
You're making a lot of sense, but the thing about it is the best way to fool others, sometimes you have to fool yourself first.
Okay.
And, I mean, if I have a new religion that I'm trying to pass off on to you, I have to make the people that would follow me believe that religion also.
Right.
And that's the basis of it all. Just like you just brought up the 30s and the 40s and the 50s as far as the advertising.
Right.
All of that is part of the iconography of racism.
Yes.
As you are well aware.
My
those
point.
People had to be, right, and those people lived in a cocoon.
But what I was saying is that racism isn't just about power and keeping people down. In fact, I would say at its core, at its cancerous kernel, it's about money. It was always about right. money. It's a, you know, slavery
that's
was about
that's
money.
The only reason, right, that's the only reason why we were brought here.
Exactly.
We weren't brought here to be citizens. We weren't brought here to be neighbors.
Right.
We weren't brought here to be friends. We weren't brought here to be students. We were brought here to work.
That's right. It's all
and
about
so
the money.
When you see somebody like Megyn Kelly sit on Fox News, which is a major corporation that is owned by two foreigners, then you see her get on TV and she looked pointedly at the camera when she said that. It was in defiance. It wasn't in friendship. It wasn't in acknowledgement. It wasn't her trying to inform. It was in defiance of reality. And it was her saying, no matter what you say, no matter what Tom Hartman says, no matter what Charles says, this is what we say and this is what we believe. Right. And so the point becomes we not worry about what they believe. As black people, we should worry about what we're trying to do.
There you go. Yeah, I'm with you. Charles, thank you for the call. Thank you for a very thoughtful and insightful perspective. And much appreciated. Thanks for watching the show there in Glenwood, Illinois. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour on the Tom Hartman Program. I think as increasingly, I think we're, you know, Megyn Kelly might have, you know, kicked off something. We're going to start seeing a lot of black Santas.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Interesting piece. I think it was in the LA Times yesterday about a guy, an African-American guy who's been Santa in a mall, and he's like a hero, right? This is going to spread. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Patrick in Park City, Utah. Whoop, there we go. Oh, Patrick, I just dumped you. I'm sorry. Tanisha in Seattle. Patrick, call back. Tanisha in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Tanisha, what's up?
Hey, how you doing?
Very well, thank
you. Well, I agree exactly with the young caller called about just before I got on this line. Mm-hmm. It's more or less like we did not come here willingly. We were forced here. And by being forced here from the time that we've got here, we built America. It stands on our shoulders. We don't get a credit for a lot of things that has happened here.
Yeah, I'm...
And at the same time that we're noted to be, you know what I'm saying, you better hold on to your purse, lock your door, you know. That's been embedded into everybody's minds about what we stand for. We're good for entertainment. We're good to run up and down a field or up and down a court, maybe around a track or something like that there. But as far as being educated, that is not something that was ever meant for us to do. One book that was given to us was the Bible. And that's the only book that you're going to know how to read. And in the same time, in the same token that they were talking about that Bible, they were talking about themselves when they spoke upon the devil. Because if you got 10 commandments that say that you're not supposed to do this, 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 and this, and you're pumping that into us, but you're not following through on what you're doing yourself, I mean, there's an issue and a problem with that. Yeah. Another thing is this.
Well, can I, before you move on to your other thing, Tanisha, can I make two comments quickly? Number one, yeah. I'm living in Washington, D.C., and I walk around this city. This city was built by slave labor, and I don't think most people know that. You know, it's like a friend of ours who's African American was walking with my wife through the Capitol building with her niece who's African American, and she was saying, "Where are the black faces?" You know, this was built by black people. This building literally was built by black people. It was built by slave labor. Number one, and I forgot my number two. Anyhow, back to you.
And not just that, but not for us though.
No.
I mean, actually, think about, I mean, I guess the statement that I'm trying to make is this. Everybody here is labeled. Like, we're now to be called African-American, and then there's Asian-American or Latino-American. The only American that's not called anything other than American is white people.
Mm-hmm.
You're not called white Americans. You're called Americans.
Right.
Everybody else has a title on them.
Well, that's the nature of the majority in every society. Not to justify it, but it's just that's, you know, Norwegians are white. If somebody comes in who's...
Once again, at the same time, to say that that a Latino or Mexican individual that was here along with the Indians before Brit or France or Columbus or any of them people came here to this country that they claim to be America, they taught them how to grow and how to live and how to make it. In the process of that, they were overthrown. Their world was overthrown.
Yeah.
Every culture on the face of this earth has had something taken by white people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I mean, everything.
Yeah.
And it's all based upon fear. Fear of what and for why? I don't know, because I believe that we all breathe. We all see each other, hear each other in some kind of way, fashion, or form.
Yeah.
We're all here together. And so it's like, and throughout it all, we didn't fight.
Yeah.
We fought with you for our own freedom. We didn't fight for our freedom. We fought against our freedom.
Yeah, no, I got it. Tanisha, Jack Forbes, Native American professor, once asked me, what was with the white people out of Europe? It's almost like there's a predator gene or something. Tanisha, thank you for the call. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, who started Goats for the Old Goat as her 60th birthday gift to the world or to herself. And through goatsfortheoldgoat.com, you can give a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan. And South Sudan is experiencing some serious turmoil right now. The New York Times had a pretty good story about it this morning. Ellen, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. You know, we do make sure that people will get their goats, even though there's this horrible conflict, because the area we operate in is pretty much one ethnic identity. But the woman who actually will give you your goat certificate is a woman by the name of Agat Dang, and she's a Dinka woman from the area of Bor. And the fighting has now moved from Juba to Bor. She has several of her siblings who live there. It's in Jonglei State. We do know that 20 civilians were killed in Bor today. And there is some talk about it going to Unity State and Upper Nile State. So far, certainly not in the area we operate in. 600 people, they think, have been killed. There is now the President Akir, who you met with, Tom, when you were there,
sure.
Is willing to meet with political opposition, and they are looking at the President of Uganda to lead some of these discussions. We do know that the President Akir also talked to the Secretary General of the United Nations today.
To what extent do you think any of this might be being instigated by Sudan, the country to the north, who's Bashir?
Well, I think a lot of it is being instigated by that, and particularly because some of these people actually made deals with the north when there was this war going on. They sort of banked on the fact that the north was going to win.
The original
Civil War. They're not generally Dinkas. They're generally the vice president who Salva Kiir fired is from, which means that they're Nuers, and N-U-E-R, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. And that's part of the big problem. And he apparently, according to reports, has been responsible for killing up to 2,000 Dinka people.
The vice president. The Nuer.
Yes. Well,
now,
no
the Nuers are the minority tribe in South Sudan, and the Dinkas are the majority tribe. Am I right?
Yeah, they're certainly the tribe in power. I don't know the numbers, actually.
I know everywhere across the north part of South Sudan that we went, it was all Dinka.
Right. Exactly.
But I don't recall Juba. Okay. So
Juba is less of a problem than places like Bor that are really quite ethnically divided. So that's
right.
What's going on there. All right. Back to more other divisions here in the good old USA.
Right.
The White House is releasing, they actually did release today, their internal security review. 40 recommendations. Honestly, I have to confess I have not read all 40 of them. But one of the biggest ones is that they are recommending that all of this data that is collected by phone companies from, you know, the cell phone company data, et cetera, remain in private hands either with a third party or with the phone companies, and that the government not collect this data. In other words, the data is available if they need to look up terrorism or something under a specific court order, but that it would not remain with the government.
Whose recommendation is this?
This is actually the White House internal review.
Oh, that's interesting.
So
what are they going to do with this billion-dollar facility out in Utah where they can store more data than the Earth has?
Well, maybe they'll have to store some Russian data or something.
Or some goats,
or anything, exactly. Also, today, Jay Carney at the White House was questioned at length about what some are calling the snub of the United States, not going to the openings of the Olympic Games in Sochi. As you know, they are sending two well-known, one is very well-known, gay athletes. One is Billie Jean King. The other is a woman named Caitlin, and I think it's Chow, I'm not sure exactly how she pronounces her names, but they are well known that. Jay Carney said, well, there wasn't a snub, but it's no secret that the United States has some issues with Russia and how they handle gay lesbian issues, GLBT as it's called. But they said, no, it's not a snub. The president's schedule just doesn't allow for it.
Is that what's history look like? Typically, have presidents gone to these opening events?
Yes, they usually do go. The one time, of course, remember when Russia invaded Afghanistan and we canceled it?
Right, Jimmy Carter.
We had a lot of very disappointed athletes, so they said we're not going to do that. But the president's schedule is busy. In other words, it's a snub, but we're not calling it a snub.
Very interesting.
There is, and just now it's happening, the vote on the budget in the Senate is happening as we speak. I don't have C-SPAN on in front of me, but it was scheduled 4:30, so my guess is that it's as we're speaking right now. And Janet Yellen, it looks like her confirmation is not going to happen until Friday. But Harry Reid is saying if the Republicans hold up this, it is going to force the Senate to work through the weekend. And, of course, this is the weekend before Christmas.
Be very interesting to watch that happen.
Very, very interesting. The president also today met with 8 mothers, and this is part of his daily, remember he promised he was daily talk about health care through Christmas, he met with 8 mothers today. There was a mother, a single mother from Virginia, a mom of 2 of Maryland, another mother of from New Jersey. Valerie Jarrett was present during this. They said that they had a rocky beginning, the president talked about, but that it is very hard not to fight when they hear the stories of these moms and the lack of health care.
Remarkable.
So, I wish I had a lot more news for you. I sort of don't today. We do know that the president is really anxious, and this has to do with the both the meeting at the White House and with the skipping the Olympics, that they are, this is going to be the sort of highlight diversity White House in the year 2014. I think word has it that this is something that the White House is going to push very heavily, and along with immigration, and that is what he's doing his major.
And just look how far we've come just since 2008.
Exactly.
I mean, it's an amazing thing. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Go to theoldgoat.com. Thank you, Ellen.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. If you support our programs, then please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Koa Beck is on the line with us. Koa is a journalist, an author, a contributor with Salon.com, and wrote a recent piece, which was the second time in, I think, about 3 weeks that I've read a piece by Koa Beck that I just couldn't stop reading, that you know, got my brain going in ways that good writing does and most people rarely do. And I wanted to invite her on to talk about this. Koa, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for having me, and thank you so much for your praises.
Well, you're a really thoughtful and brilliant writer, and you're dealing with some real issues of consequence. The article that just came out, America's New Relationship Trend, When Husbands and Wives Aren't Actually Married, I found fascinating. I want to get into that. And then the piece that you wrote back in early December, I passed for white and straight even though I'm not, How Looks Hide My Identity. If we have a minute, we only have 6-7 minutes here, but I'd like to just ask you a little bit about that. But let's start out. Is that okay?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank
cool.
you.
Let's start out with this new trend, as it were. Now I'm an old guy, right? and I'm noticing that in my generation, the people who are in their 50s and 60s, that there are people who are choosing to not be married, or to, if it's a second marriage or a first relationship after, you know, not being married, or even get divorced for tax purposes or Social Security purposes. But that's not what you're talking about here. This is a trend, by and large, among young people, among people in their 20s and 30s.
Yeah, it's primarily millennials, but I have seen, I spoke with people upwards of 40 who had made these sorts of choices. And what you're saying is absolutely consistent. You're a baby boomer, correct?
Yes. Yeah, I'm 62.
Yeah, and with baby boomers, what we're seeing is they are actually, by far and large, the ones getting the most divorces. And younger people around millennials and even Gen X's, they're embracing these sort of alternative models for relationships and family.
Right, and in both cases, not getting divorces because, you know, hey, I'm sick of you, but getting divorces because there's a tax advantage to getting the divorce or a Social Security advantage.
I have encountered that in my research, yes.
Yeah, okay. Pardon my interrupting you.
It's all right. So specifically with millennials and Gen Xers, what we're seeing is families who are committed, who are monogamous, and who are choosing to entwine themselves financially. and who are even having children, but they are deciding not to marry, as one of my sources said. It's not so much a decision to marry or resisting marriage, but they haven't decided to marry. And they're having children, yet when they are in social settings, professional settings, they use this matrimonial terminology. They refer to each other as husband and wife. And that I found particularly compelling in that many of the couples I spoke to had a political resistance to marriage. You know, they had an ideological opposition to either the institution or the language, and yet they chose to employ it, which I find to be very telling about lingering stigmas, especially for women who have children and who are not legally married.
Right, the single mom thing that Jerry Falwell constantly railed against and that the religious right continues to. But on the other hand, there are, I mean, marriage used to be a legal contract about, by and large, about ownership of women by men. But nowadays, more, increasingly, it becomes a legal agreement about who gets whose assets, who can visit who in the hospital, who gets to make end-of-life decisions. This is important stuff to set aside. You know, young people have strokes and accidents and horrible things happen to them as well, millennials and Gen Xers, where if you're not the legal spouse of a person, suddenly you're kicked out of the hospital.
Yeah, and I think it is telling that these are younger people who are making these choices. Who, as you said, have yet to run up against these sorts of things. And as this particular cohort ages with these types of relationship models, I'm going to be very interested to see what they eventually end up doing.
Yeah, because I mean, these are the main arguments that are being made by gay people for wanting to be married, by and large, and a lot of the gay people who are getting married are not millennials, they're boomers.
Right. Yeah, I believe the most recent statistics that I encountered, I mean, my piece was about hetero couples, but right now, most of these same-sex couples that are getting married in the United States have been together 10, 20 years, you know, multi-decade relationships.
Right.
And what certain experts envision happening is that eventually that will level off, and then gay marriage will mirror that of straight marriage, and that, you know, it'll stall and be on a decline. But of course, you know, we're not there yet. So we'll...
Yeah, it's just a whole fascinating topic, and I don't know exactly where to go with it, or even that a position needs to be taken on it, other than, gee, this is fascinating. Check this out. We're talking with Koa Beck, her newest piece about marriage in the United States, over at Salon.com. And then this previous piece, it was reprinted. I saw the reprint over at Alternet, and I know that they sometimes change headlines. I'm not sure if this was your original headline. But the headline and subhead over at Alternet was, "I passed for white and straight even though I'm not. How looks hide my identity. I'm neither straight nor white, but I'm frequently mistaken for both, and it's taught me a lot about privilege." And I'm curious, first of all, if that wasn't the original headline, could you give us that so people can find it at Salon.com? And
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, and then secondly, I was going to ask, what would you want to say to white people about white privilege? Because most, my experience has been, as a white guy, the most white people don't even understand what white privilege is.
Well, as for the headline, I don't remember exactly what the Salon was, but it didn't deviate from the Alternate one too much. It was essentially that same notion that passing provides me with these certain privileges. And what I would say to a primarily white audience, I've also encountered resistance to this idea of white privilege and also hetero privilege. And I would say that there's a lot of space and a lot of resources out there now that there haven't been, 50, 60 years ago, to really understand the privileges that you're imbued with just by embodying this cohort. And that some of the responses I've gotten from that essay have, of course, been, you know, very typical in resistance. But I have also received emails from people who are white, who are straight, who saw through my sort of double consciousness in these roles, the privileges they have in their everyday life, and I'm happy to have had that impact on people.
Yeah, I'm not talking about pushback. I'm talking about just plain old ignorance. The white people don't, you know, you get these white people, these tea partiers who say, "Hey, I brought myself up by my own bootstraps," and you're like, "Yeah, you were born white in a middle class neighborhood with public education." You know, a good public education. And they go, yeah, so? And you say, well, you know, it's, and they just don't have the experience of what it would be like to be born poor and black in a neighborhood where the schools are falling apart, for example.
Yeah, and of course, how, you know, having lighter skin or being able to pass as straight or, you know, these are identities that when people read you as them, you are treated differently. And I know that that can be rather abrasive for some people, and I have encountered people virtually who are uncomfortable with that notion, you know, even being articulated in 2013, which is very alarming to me.
Yes.
That we choose very actively to live in the fantasy of equality for all, and you know, it's very propagandistic.
Right. And I think a lot of people have not, even people who have thought about white privilege have not thought about straight privilege.
Definitely not, yeah. And I encountered that with some people on Twitter who, you know, are very, I would say, like, racially literate.
Right.
But who had not given a second chance to the fact that, you know, when they are in public with an opposite sex partner, that, you know, if they hold hands or if they exchange a kiss, it goes unread. But, you know, when I hold my fiancé's hand, it's absolutely charged in certain environments.
Yes, absolutely. Koa Beck, you are brilliant. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you again for having me.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You can find Koa's writings over at Salon.com. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh, that's interesting. Medicine Eagle, watching Free Speech TV in Mayetta, Kansas. Hey, Medicine Eagle, welcome to the program.
Yeah, that's Mayetta, Kansas.
Mayetta, my apologies.
Yeah, I just wanted to say a couple of things, but one of them was congratulations, Dr. Hartman, on your honorary PhD.
From Goddard College, right, let us not forget. A great college.
Very proud of you.
Thank you.
So, Also, I wanted to say that when I worked for NATO 40 years ago, when I was in my 20s, I was sent to Holland quite often to work, and there was a parade which had I know I remember this correctly, Santa had black elves.
Yeah, I think they were called Schwarzpeter. Was that the name, Black Peters?
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, their names were Peter, it wasn't a pejorative, it was just...
With at my age, they referred to them as slaves of Santa.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. See, I
you know, and I don't know if that comes from, you know, a prejudice that was there, but you think South Africa.
Almost certainly. I mean,
like,
you know, the slave trade through Northern Europe was a big deal back a couple hundred years ago, and that's probably
absolutely
when it emerged. I can't say that I honestly know anything about it other than having seen those, you know, having seen the black elves, as it were, the black helpers to a white Santa in Holland. In fact, I think the Christmas of 9/11, nobody was traveling, and everybody was afraid to get on an airplane. And I had a couple hundred thousand frequent flyer miles that I'd accumulated over previous years. And United, as I recall, or maybe it was Delta, I forget which airline I was flying back then, had dropped the number of miles it took to fly because they wanted people to burn through they wanted to fill our airplanes.
Sure.
And so we took our three kids to Holland on a trip that just using frequent flyer miles that would have normally been the equivalent of just, you know, a round trip first class ticket to San Francisco. And we got a $400 a night room at the Marriott next door to the Rijksmuseum for $110 a night. I mean, it was incredible. The air was just evacuated. Nobody was flying that, and I did see a Santa with, and that's where I'm remembering this Schwarzpeter from, a Santa with the black helpers. I don't remember the characterization, whether it was a physical, you know, whether it was, you know, in a picture that I saw, but I remember that very vividly.
Yeah, and the comment that was made to me just by these young guys, you know, they. They also worked for NATO, you know, and that's the crowd I hung around with and went out with. Now, there's one other thing, just quickly. Did you ever mention about the Time magazine cover of what Jesus really looked like?
Oh, that was like a decade ago, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a long time ago, but you know, it was pretty interesting saying that he definitely would not have had blue eyes.
No.
Very short in stature, short curly hair, because long hair to those people on a man was, you know, discriminated against. They had a lot of problems with men with long hair, and they would force them to get it cut, you know, or cut it for them.
Very interesting. Yeah, I remember when that cover came out. I'm not sure I ever read the story, but, I'm surprised that that cover hasn't made it into the Megyn Kelly dialogue. I guess it's been long enough that the generation of people writing right now were little kids at the time or something. I don't know. Medicine Eagle, thanks for the call. It's always great to hear from you, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, and Stephen in New York City. Hey, Stephen, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Good.
And I hope the same for you.
Say again?
And I wish the same for you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I was just telling Danielle that in reference to the woman that you had on a little while ago, the white privilege thing.
Koa Beck.
Yes. Peggy McIntosh wrote an article. It's available online if you want to look it up, about white privilege, unpacking the invisible knapsack.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes into discussing how white people take advantage of these privileges without even knowing that they're available to you.
Sure.
And,
or more importantly, not knowing that they're not available to people who aren't white.
Right. That's who she mentioned. And the fact that they haven't earned these rights, you know, they're just naturally given. And,
that's right.
A lot of other people who are minorities, anyway, that have these rights, work very hard to earn.
That's right.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I used to refer to white privilege as being a member of the Lucky Sperm Club. And,
yeah, I've heard you say that many times.
You know, yeah, and it's just, it's like white people don't realize what they have been given by being born white. And interestingly, I mean, you know, one of the comments, and right across the board, I used to do a lot of international relief work, and I've traveled to some real hellholes on this planet, and I've traveled with relief workers who were not just white, who were also African American and who were Asian American, and I'm not sure I've ever worked with a Latino in doing international relief work, but. But repeatedly I hear the comment that Americans don't value what they're born with, regardless of race. Now, the problem with saying that, of course, is that that's what Bill O'Reilly would say. You know, that's the right-wing meme, is that, you know, poor black people in America are wealthier than middle-class people in, you know, the Democratic Republic of the Congo or in parts of Central America or South America. But
I do believe that some of that arrogance does rub off.
Yeah, yeah. But it's like all of us, I don't know, gratitude for me has always been the most powerful emotion. It's the thing that awakens me and you know, just saying thank you, just waking up in the morning and saying thank you to the universe for another day of life. And getting past being a victim is like really important. At the same time, you know, that has been so misused and so abused by the right wingers of the world.
Victimization?
Yeah, the idea that some people are victims and are proclaiming it, because there are some people who actually are victims, and a lot of them, and it's worth acknowledging. I mean, we praise people who rose above their victimhood, but we also have to acknowledge that there is this. And there's a new book coming out in about 3 months. I just wrote a blurb for it. I got an advance copy, and I wrote a blurb for it about class. And this is just amazing. This the professor, the woman who wrote this book, did some amazing research done over several decades, found that actually class is a more powerful determinant of a person's future and their ability to succeed in America, the class into which they're born, the class into which they're raised, then is race. And that's the subtext that's going on. That's one of the battleground subtexts that's going on in many minority communities is, you know, the person who, the African-American who, quote, talks white or behaves white, in quotes, it's really not about race. It's about class. and these class struggles that are going on. And I'm really looking forward to that book coming out because I want to start having some serious conversations about that. Because it's not just white privilege. There's also middle class privilege. There's upper class privilege. And there's lower class struggles and difficulties. And we don't even, Americans don't even generally acknowledge class. I mean, class is something that is readily acknowledged in Europe, but we don't even generally understand it well enough to talk about it. So, Stephen, excellent point. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to WWRL. Tom in Renton, Washington. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Great. You wanted to update me on the Boeing negotiations? We heard from a caller before the end of the last hour that Boeing had come back with another offer, but the bosses of the union, and I don't know if this is true or not, were saying, no, we're not going to let the membership have a vote on it. Is that true?
That's a very confused picture, but
Ray, it sounds like a right-wing portrayal, frankly, but I don't know.
Well, remember, the CEO, McDerney, cut his teeth under Jack Welch, and he left GE because he didn't get the head job when Welch left. So he's very much a Wall Street CEO.
Yeah, and Welch was just a relentless predator, you know.
Oh, yeah. And so Ray Conner sent out a message to all the employees on Monday. This all took place last week. And he admitted that he had told the union negotiators that he was stipulating that they give a positive endorsement to the membership on this deal. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that really muddied the waters. The whole thing is about getting rid of the pensions and getting labor peace to avoid strikes. There was a real famous incident that happened here in Seattle 5 years ago. Richard Branson from Virgin Airlines ripped Boeing a new one because his brand new 77 was delayed 3 months by an IAM strike.
Right. We have just a half a minute left, Tom, if you can get to the chase.
So Boeing, it's a lose-lose situation. They want to get rid of the pensions, but they aren't going to coerce the IAM into giving them up, and so they're going to move the 777 line out. Well, they'll still have all the other employees here building the 37s and the 87s. So to get rid of their pensions, it literally means the slippery slope. They have to move the whole company out.
Yeah, this is the beginning of the end if this thing goes down, and it's the beginning of the end either way. Because labor is going to lose either really big really fast or really big over time. Tom, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
This could all be prevented if we just listened to Bernie Sanders and said any state that offers incentives, financial incentives for an American corporation to move out of another state loses its federal highway funds. This is really interesting, a really interesting juxtaposition. I haven't read the article in the New York Times, but the headline is words to the effect of how John McCain went from being the maverick to the cranky old man to the thoughtful senior senator from Vermont, from Arizona. You know, it was basically, I remember looking at the headline thinking John McCain's PR people really scored one there. Because, you know, guys like John McCain actually have PR people and they go out and they pitch stories to places like the New York Times. And then I'm looking at Talking Points memo, and the headline says, McCain introduces Obamacare repeal and replace legislation. And the picture caption, Senator John McCain said Wednesday he would introduce a bill to repeal Obamacare and replace it with his own set of reforms. Yeah. Okay. On it goes. Right, the beat goes on. Malcolm in Park Forest, Illinois. Hey, Malcolm, what's on your mind?
Hi, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Listen, I don't have a problem with Santa being white. I mean, it's a European tradition. St. Nick, it came out of Europe, so I don't have any problem with it. When I was a child, I sat on Santa's knee in Goldblatt for Marshall Field, and I never gave it a second thought as a child.
Hmm.
And racial attitudes and things have a lot to do with demographics. Now, I happen to have been born to a middle-class family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I sat at the breakfast table with lawyers and PhDs in economics and dentists and doctors and things like that. That was my upbringing, my brother and I. And I also went to a Catholic school from sixth grade on up through high school. And so I had white buddies. I had white people, you know, that I interacted with. I mean, good friends, the priests and the nuns and things, in addition to having a rich cultural tradition in the black community. So I had the best of both worlds.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a problem with anybody. And when I was younger, I went through the militant stage in the late 50s and early 60s, you know, during the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a learning process. So now that I've grown old, I have a lot more wisdom. So you, even in the South, if you are a black middle class in the South, you have a different experience than dirt poor, you know, tenant farmer that's black.
Yeah, that was my point earlier, that this new research that's coming out shows that in America, class is a larger factor in quality of life, outcome of life, everything, than his race.
It has a lot to do with it. Now, being black middle class didn't mean that I wasn't discriminated against. You know, I got called the N-word so much in high school, I thought that was my middle name or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I was able to work through that because I've always been strong mentally, physically, spiritually. It wasn't a big deal. I came from a wonderful mother who taught me about black culture. I mean, going all the way back to Africa, even ancient Africa. That was another leg up I had on a lot of poor black kids that didn't have that at home.
Mm-hmm.
So demographics, class has a lot to do with it, and I'm not bragging or trying to be better than anyone else, but I had the best of both worlds. I'm proud of being who I am, you know, what I look like. I've never been ashamed of being black. I never felt inferior because I came from that type of background. Now, people that were born in the housing projects or illiterate people, you know, that are black, that's a different experience, and they have a different way of looking and feeling about life.
And I suspect that there are white people in Appalachia or white people in poor community, and I've encountered a few of them in my life. You know, the quote trailer trash end quote, the people, white people who are really who are born into deep grinding multi-generational poverty.
The Wonderful Whites of Virginia. Have you seen that documentary put out by Showtime, The Wonderful Whites of West Virginia?
No, I haven't.
Okay, Showtime put that out. See if you can get a hold of a copy of that, and you're talking about an eye opener.
Yeah.
I think you really enjoy that.
But these,
learn a lot from it.
These are probably folks who view themselves as being inferior and you know, experience many of the same issues that you're describing, people who come from the lower socioeconomic class in the African-American community experience.
They don't feel inferior. They're angry as hell about being poor coal miners who've been exploited.
Right.
Mistreated by the white, their own, you know, white people millionaires, but they don't feel inferior. In fact, they have a lot of rich cultural traditions, especially tap dancing.
Uh-huh.
They have a family that just as good as Gregory Hines or anybody else tap dancing.
Yeah.
In fact, I think tap dancing primarily came out of Europe in the first place.
Yeah, I don't know.
We adopted it. Black people adopted it, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fascinating stuff.
You have a nice holiday in case I don't talk to you anymore. You
Thank
and your
you.
Staff and your wife and you're really a wonderful resource for spiritual inspiration and education, Tom, and I don't know what I'd do without you. I listen to you every day.
Well, thank you, Malcolm, and I appreciate your calls. They're always thoughtful and insightful, and I appreciate you. I wish you the very best of the holiday season. Merry Christmas, whatever is appropriate. Happy holidays, and thanks for listening.
Is your wife your producer?
Yeah, she is.
Is that who answers the phone?
Yeah, no. Louise isn't. That's Danielle's the associate producer. She.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
God bless them too.
Amen.
I know you wouldn't be able to make it without those two.
No, without Danielle and Shane and Louise and Jim and
right.
and in particular Sean Taylor out in Portland, who is the executive producer of the program. She books all our guests and everything and helps us determine our topics and.
Okay, man. Well, good luck in the new year. I hope you're around a long time, you know.
Thank you.
Nope.
And Sue and Nigel,
okay.
There's a whole bunch of us. Anyhow, Malcolm, thank you for the call. Great to hear from you. Michael in Rockland, California. Hey, Michael.
Yeah. Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine. What's up?
I'm 53 years old, something I don't really like to publish. And 2 years ago, Hewlett-Packard laid me off, and before they laid me off, they made me train 6 people in Guadalajara to replace me.
Wow.
So outsourcing is kind of been a thorn in my side for a while. What I learned in that is that the basis of the H-1B, and it's a little bit different thing, but the basis of the H-1B, the claim basis, is that we're bringing in people with superior skills. Mm-hmm. The superior skill I think most people on H-1Bs are bringing in is that they're willing to work for less than half of what I'm willing
to because
work
when they send half their paycheck home to their family, it represents a lot of money.
Correct. And not only that, I'm sure you know this as well, but H-1B people are working under the constant threat of being deported. If they don't make their employers absolutely delighted, the employer can send them right back to India or Mexico or wherever they want to go.
Right.
If they reach green card status, then that threat is lifted, but they still work for relatively low wages compared to what I'm making.
Yeah.
And then the last assault on my career has been the fact that HP actually asked me to interview and hire people in Mumbai, India, and Guadalajara and so forth, and I was to interview them and use my skill and experience in selecting appropriate people and hiring them. And then after years of facilitating this basically outsourcing one means or another, HP laid me off.
Wow.
So I've been listening to – I'll be brief, I promise. I've been listening to Paul Craig Roberts and to you. You guys are my two favorite commentators. You seem to get it better than anyone else does. Dr. Roberts suggested a resolution that lit me up. Just absolutely, I got excited about it. It sounds like the right medicine. What he said is we need to change our tax code for corporations to reward them and give them credits for hiring domestic, you know, residents of the United States, and give them tax deficits, basically make it more costly for them to hire people offshore or non-residents domestically.
Right.
When I heard that, I thought, what a simple, perfect idea to resolve this problem. It was absolute assault on American workers.
Yeah, it's a human variation on tariffs, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It makes perfect sense.
It does. And the thing I'm wondering is, why is our government not embracing that medicine?
Because the Supreme Court has said that money is actually protected under the First Amendment of the Constitution as speech. And because money is protected, legislators cannot prevent it from flowing into Washington, D.C., or into state capitals, for that matter. And so large corporations that profit tremendously from having people like you train your six replacements in Mexico, or train people in India, or for that matter, train people who are going to come in on H-1B visas, those corporations make a lot of money from that, and they take a certain percentage of that money and recycle it into the pockets of the politicians who make the laws that make that possible. And there is no money in making it more expensive for corporations. It would just be the individual workers. And that's why, until we get money out of politics, until we amend the Constitution to say money is not speech, the Supreme Court made a horrible mistake. And by the way, it was a 5-4 decision in Citizens United. But it's not just Citizens United that needs to be rolled back. It goes back to Buckley versus Vallejo, which is another 5-4 decision, as I recall. And arguably it goes back even before that. I'm going to sneeze in a second here, but we need to fix this. Excuse me. And the way to do that is to amend the Constitution to unambiguously say money is not speech and therefore is not protected under the First Amendment, and therefore Congress can regulate money in politics. And corporations are not people. And they are not protected by the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause, that all people have the same protections. And therefore, corporations can be regulated by the federal government or state governments or even local communities. And only when we do those two things are we going to see rational policies that benefit average working people put into place in the United States. Until then, it is going to be plutocracy, plutocracy, plutocracy. All policies passed are going to be passed, by and large, that benefit big corporations.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And even the policies that seem to benefit the average working person, like Obamacare, for example, benefit big corporations. It's all done with private for-profit giant health insurance companies. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ed in Erie, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV on the DirecTV satellite system. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Fine.
Hey, I'd like to say my cat Tinkerbell passed the same day as Higgins.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I kind of got a feeling that they were together crossing those pearly gates.
Well, hopefully
they're up there now, purring and waiting for us to get there.
There you go. Hopefully, yeah. Tinkerbell and Higgins are having a good time
getting
together.
Getting that all aside, the Bible, it doesn't say peace on earth, goodwill towards men. It says peace on earth to men of goodwill.
Are you sure?
Yes. Yes. The original Hebrew written Bible says peace on earth to men of goodwill.
Okay, but the King James translation says to...
Right, well, you remember the story of Jesus going out in the desert and Satan trying to change God's words to him and him correcting him every step of the way. Well, someone's got to be there to correct these people. There is no such thing as...
Okay, the New Testament, by the way, was originally written in Aramaic and Greek, not in Hebrew.
That's exactly right. And when you start transferring languages, words change, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the meaning of words. Yeah. But that aside, that Megyn Kelly and her depiction of Jesus and
Santa as being white.
Santa Claus, Santa Claus is a fictional character, okay?
Right.
Everyone knows that. And, I mean, for her to decide that the race is insane. The black people in America, her African Americans, they were the first victims of capitalism. You know, with the Navigation Act.
Well, arguably they were the second. We were killing Indians before we were importing slaves. But, yeah.
Yeah, but that was more...
The first colony in the United States was called Jamestown, and it was named after King James, who was the largest stockholder in the British East India Company.
You're 100% correct. And
it was established by the East India Company for economic purposes, and they named the Virginia, the state in which Jamestown was established, they named Virginia after the Virgin Queen, Queen Elizabeth I, who at that point was deceased, but she was the original charterer in 1601. She chartered the British East India Company. She was the one who started the company. So both Jamestown and Virginia were named after the patrons of the East India Company. It was all about the money. And, you know, killing the Indians was all about the money. Bringing the slaves over was all about the money. It's like bizarre stuff.
But the Navigation Act established that only English ships could bring slaves to America.
Yes.
And it had to be captained by English captains.
Right.
You know, and these slaves had to be sold in the Americas.
But this was in the 1600s and the early 1700s.
Yeah, but by 1776, 40% of the African Americans in this country were free people. They were purchased by the churches and by the Puritans and the Quakers who first populated this country, you know, and a lot of them were free people. They had.
Yeah, I know that. 40% sounds really, really high to me, but I know that there were free blacks in Delaware and in New Jersey who were voting in elections after, you know, the founding of the Republic. That, you know, they pretty much did away with that, you know, after 1800, but fascinating. Ed, if you can give me a source for that 40% number, post it on our blog or something, or send it to me, I'd love to see it. I think that that's a little high, but I get your point. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll be right back. It's the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. And Charles in Chicago. Hey, Charles.
Mr. Hartman, how goes it, sir?
Great. You wanted to talk about Santa.
Yes. Being a person of color, and I was born in the 50s, 1957, we were aware of Christmas. We were also aware of a lot of things that weren't inclusive to our black culture. I had a cousin named Kelvin, I swear to God, but his mother drank coffee. He thought she was breaking the law because he never saw black people drinking on TV.
Whoa.
This is the truth. So when I think of Santa, I never think of race. I think of what he is to the children. As I learned more in school, I found out that any culture of a people who were actually invaded and taken into bondage is just a reflection of the conqueror's culture. Mm-hmm. Many natives here wouldn't know nothing about Jesus unless it was brought upon, forced upon them, like the people from Africa.
Right.
He didn't know anything about Jesus until it was shoved down our throats.
Yep.
Now, with this gentleman who was calling from the publication, he was a younger person of color. I don't think he understands the struggle of our blackness of being accepted,
mm-hmm.
being called names, being excluded just because you were black, not being recognized on television except roles of butler or somebody helping.
Right.
I don't think he understands fully the privilege that being white once carried. It still does carry some privilege today.
Yeah.
But as the older bigots die out, it becomes a more inclusive world. I think he just thinks that everybody was just born equal. Everything was just okay. To this day, it's not a level playing field. It's a lot better. But as far as Jesus and Santa and the other things, the history will bear out that St. Nicholas, of course, was born in Turkey.
Right.
History will bear out that Jesus was born in the Middle East, and certainly was not classic Caucasian. My friends, you know, they kind of make fun of it when I always call him classic white Jesus, the guy you see on TV, the blonde, benevolent guy,
right.
Just so pale and living in the sun all the time. I don't get it.
Yeah.
But when you bring it to people like that, they have to understand that this culture is a culture of many things, not just one, except the conqueror's culture is the one that will be reflected upon most. If you don't believe that, look at Islam.
No, I think, yeah.
Taliban.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, Charles. Charles, I got a bunch of other calls I want to get in here, but thank you for the call. Excellent points. Yes, and the victors write history. Dana in Marsing, Idaho. Hey, Dana.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Fine.
I was calling about the white privilege, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm 61 years old, and I remember when I got my first job, I applied at a place that made water skiing,
mm-hmm.
ropes and things. And there was a line of people out there, and there was a black girl that was a little older than me that was in front of me. And she came out after her interview and told everyone in line that the position has been filled.
Mm.
And she left, and I thought they were going to come out and tell us all that we had to go home. But I ended up actually getting the job, and so did several people behind me.
Because you were a white person,
and
so were they.
Knew, that's right. And they were all white, yes. Yeah, she was the only black African-American in the line.
Right.
And, boy, that really made an effect to me. And I realized, actually many times over my work career, that I benefited because I was not only white, but because I was blonde, blue-eyed.
Mm-hmm.
And I even noticed one time a man put on a application when he was interviewing me. He wrote down pretty white.
Yeah.
Pretty blonde.
Oh, there's
you know.
There are privileges and advantages associated with being attractive, with being white, with being, I mean, right. And attractive can be in any race. I mean, there's, yeah. This is where we get into this broad realm of class and appearance, and it's fascinating stuff. Dana, thanks for sharing your story with us. Carl in Palm Desert, California. Hey, Carl.
Hi, how you doing, Tom? Thank you very much for everything you have done.
You got a tidbit about Rudolph?
Yes, I do. My wife and I were watching an old Western the other day, Gene Autry, and of course, he lived and had a hotel in Palm Springs about 10 miles down the road, so I followed him a long time. But anyway, we were talking about his first wife and second wife, wondered if he had any kids. And so my wife Googled it and found out, and I hope I'm right about this, but he's the one that authored Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Gene Autry?
And according to Google now.
Shane says he thinks it was Johnny Mercer, but I don't have a clue. So that's
very
interesting.
And then he also wrote other Christmas songs that you would recognize. I forgot them right now.
Yeah.
But I thought that was really interesting. According to the Google, he was really reluctant to release Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Fascinating. So, fascinating. I'm going to have to check that out. Carl, thanks for calling and sharing that. Sarah, we have a little less than a minute. You got a quick one?
Yeah. When I came up as a kid in Columbus, Ohio, you know, I could even hear the foot, you know, the reindeer over the rooftop. You know mm-hmm. what I'm saying? That's how my parents made it. So to me, it's a spirit of Christmas. My
right.
parents are African Americans. And it's the spirit. It's not a color. I mean, obviously, you know, when I went to school, the Santa Claus that we were passed out with the dittos and all, you know, they were white.
Right.
But I didn't think of it in any way other than, hey, I'm going to get those gifts at Christmas time.
That's fascinating.
It wasn't associated with race. So to do right. that now, it, to me, is asinine.
Okay. Okay. Sarah, thank you for sharing that. This is fascinating. I can't speak from first person experience on this. I'm just watching the whole thing unfold. I'm finding it fascinating. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have all the news and information you won't hear on the corporate-owned news media, along with your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. So get over to pdamerica.org or movetoamend.org or one of any of the other great organizations out there and occupy something. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman Program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.